Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators. Together, we've published somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 books. We've worked for all the major publishers in the business, and we've all taught illustration at university art programs.
That's right. Each week we come at you guys with listener questions and fantastic interviews on the topic of illustration. Sometimes we agree, sometimes we argue, but each time you learn something brand spanking new.
All right. Will, Terry, you've got a big update for us. Tell us what is going on at your house right now.
Well, we got our books and we started selling books, and it's Pickleball Paul. And so if you're not into pickleball, it might not be something that you're into, but it's a children's book, it's a storybook on basically a hero's journey on not being good enough to play and then working through those fears and everything and with friends and all, and happy endings at the end. I decided to self-publish this one because it's such a strong niche, and I didn't think that the big publishers would be going after it anytime soon. And, you know, they're not currently. And also that the people that might enjoy this book are easy to find because there's such a tight-knit community. If you've never heard of pickleball before, you will. In fact, they estimate that it's going to be in everybody's elementary school and junior high in the next 5 to 10 years. So,
What I love about it is that, you know, Will was already playing it, and all of us at SVS, me, Jake, our producer, David at the time, we all met in Arizona, and Will wanted to show us how to play pickleball. And by two games in, we were all playing decently enough. Whereas if you tried to do that with almost any other sport, you're flopping around, you know, for the whole first day or two at best.
We also disc golf. And me and Will, by the end of it, you just schooled us. Like,
That one's going to take is a longer learning curve for sure. But the pickleball was fun. It was accessible.
It's cheap. It's easy to do for elderly people. So it's really, I mean, it's the pros are all young. There's young kids, 16-year-olds that are winning the pro circuit right now. And but it is accessible to all ages. And so anyway, so I decided to write a book for that group, and I have 5 books planned in the series. We received 5,000 books a week ago, and in 1 week, I was just looking at stats this morning. I'm selling on my website, which is pickleball-paul.com, and if anybody is into pickleball and wants a book there, use coupon code PICKLEWILL. Just PICKLEWILL, W-I-L-L. And then so I have some stats here. I'm actually going to make a YouTube video this next week on this.
Will drop. Your YouTube videos come out on Monday or Tuesday?
Monday.
Okay, this will drop right after that.
So that's cool.
So
I'm getting money in 5 different ways on this, which is kind of unique. And one is through the website sales. But then I found a partner before I actually went in on this, I actually talked to this guy who's been a salesman as a career. He's 70 years old now and still highly motivated. Some people just want to work, you know, and this guy is just hungry and motivated and still likes to work. And he plays pickleball. He's an avid pickleball player. He knows all the pros in the business. And so when I brought this to him, he was already selling at tournaments, other products. And when I brought this to him, his eyes just lit up. He's like, Will, I could sell this to the grandparents all day long. And so we went over some plans and anyway, made it. So he and I are partners, although he's going to work as an independent contractor. We're not partnered on the product, but I've given him like exclusive distribution management rights. So like I won't distribute to other people without his knowledge and without him getting a cut. And that way he's going to manage vendors at tournaments all over the country. So there's tournaments going on every single week. And that's where we think most of the sales are going to occur. He's already been to a few really, really small ones. And at the small ones, he sold about 40 books. And then other distributors are taking possession of these through wholesale. So this week alone, I can give you my stats. Mm-hmm. When I sell a book, and I've had like a lot of the people I play pickleball with obviously want one. So just this week, I sold 625 books to that group. Or sorry, $625 worth to that group. Bill has sold so far $1,500 worth. My personal wholesale sales to someone that I who wants to sell them, I worked with Bill on that. But because I made that connection, I sold $2,200 worth of books to that person. Mm-hmm. Bill has sold this week $1,050. So I'm actually beating my salesman this week. And then the website generated $2,400. So all told in the first week, $7,700. My costs on books are $9,000 for the book alone.
Okay.
So I've done pretty good in the first week of getting back up to zero.
Yeah.
But I do have a lot of other expenses set up on like making the website. And I also printed posters. And I also had to pay a designer to design my book. So I'm going to go into a detailed breakdown on my YouTube channel where I've been doing a series on this whole project from start to finish. And I'm going to ongoingly share those statistics. I'm actually this week going to start a, what do you call it? Like the thermometer, the stupid little thermometer thing where like the money like raising
tracks
up.
Your progress. Oh,
right. Yeah. And so it's in the red. And I should have done this more in the beginning, but I'll show like how far in the red I actually am and mm-hmm. where I'm climbing out. And every week, I think I'll do an update on that to show people. But this has been just the funnest project to work on. And last night we were in the hot tub and we happened to meet a woman who is she's a school teacher, but she does these circles in like, she called them circles, but they're like SEL social mm-hmm. something. Learning some social and emotional learning.
Okay.
And it's a big thing in public schools now. And she writes these curriculums for teachers and she goes to school from school to school now as a consultant doing these circles. So this is like a serendipitous thing, right? She read the book, loved it, said it would be perfect for teaching this thing called SEL, and said she'll write a circle on it and take it to schools and they all buy the book. So that's like,
that's amazing.
Just another little thing that kind of fell into my, if it happens, you know.
What's been more work, illustrating the book or being a publisher, a self-publisher?
Probably more work is the marketing side because it's the least fun. Mm-hmm. However, it's also really fun, and some parts of it are also really fun. The biggest thing is the stress I'm feeling on having time to do the next book. Mm. You know, because I have my duties with SVS that I need to do, and we've talked about projects that we want to do.
Yeah.
So I've got that going on.
That's always my problem with a book that we talked about with promoting anything, whether it's with a traditional publisher or you're doing it on your own, is the second you start promoting the other thing that you already did, then you can't make something new, which is your next revenue stream.
Right.
It's a huge
problem. What I've done to combat that is I've put myself on a schedule where I'm going to push forward on the book at the same time. So I dedicate a certain amount of hours to drawing. And well, I've already written the second, the book and had it edited, I'm going to push forward because I've given myself a deadline of the end of June for the second book so that, you know, I worked with my book broker and my designer on their schedules so that I can get books sometime in October, early November for Christmas. So I'm like trying to act like a publisher would in mm-hmm. putting myself on a schedule to schedule out my time, because I think this thing really has legs. The probably the biggest advice, if this, if you know, this is early, but if this project works, probably the biggest thing I've learned is that you should be thinking about marketing before you even write your book if you're going to self-publish. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Because in theory, your publisher is going to do at least some marketing for you that you don't have to do at all.
Right.
But if you're the person in charge of your own marketing, you have to think, begin with the end in mind, going, well, what is my message and who is it to? Mm-hmm. And how am I going to get that message to them? Mm-hmm. And for this book, I saw it right away. I mean, the idea of this book wasn't even mine. It was a sales rep for a pickleball paddle manufacturer who just said, oh, you're a children's book illustrator? You should do a children's book on pickleball. And I was like, wow, easy to find group. Mm-hmm. It's funny too, because we think that big publishing deals are always the way to go. And sometimes they are. I got an email. It's really long. I won't read it. We could maybe do a deep dive on this sometime on the podcast. But I got an email from the YouTube video. This guy left a comment, kind of teased some information that he had. And I said, yeah, send me more to my email. And he wrote me this long letter, and it was basically, he and a friend wrote a middle grade novel, and they were self-publishing it. A big publisher found it, saw it, liked it, bought it from him, and gave him a 5-book deal, but didn't pay him for the 5 books, just paid him for the one, right?
Oh, yeah.
But got him under contract for 5 books. And it's very long, all the things that happened. You know, he's like, he actually listed out all the pros and cons, but basically the publisher is sitting on it and has decided not to do anything with it, market or anything. So they're completely locked out of their 5-book series right now. They haven't gotten hardly any money. The publisher isn't doing anything to market it. They've done, all the sales have come from them. They've did like 50 book signings, scheduled all these book signings, and have been doing, I mean, he's listed all the things they did, and he's like, I can guarantee you that all of our sales, which are very, very lackluster, were from their own personal efforts. And so
at that point, you're like, why have a publisher?
Right. And I'm not saying that publishers are bad. I mean, like, if your books are selling well, having a big publisher behind you, there's probably nothing better.
Right.
Although even to that, I would say, if you haven't seen Brandon Sanderson's, what is his series called?
Mistborn?
No. The one that he did on Kickstarter.
Oh, I don't know.
Something of the Kings.
I saw the Kickstarter. That guy's so stinking prolific. I can't even finish one of his books, much less keep track of all the books he's written.
Well, he had some kind of thing, and I can't remember exactly what it was. I don't think it was a beef with his publisher so much as it was a disagreement on how to market. And I think he did that series to show them what was possible, and he raised $43 million dollars on Kickstarter. If you haven't seen that, you got to go look for it.
Did you see the drama stirred up by the Wired article on him last week?
I did. I didn't read it yet. I've got it marked to read.
I'm not a Brandon Sanderson fan. Like, I know people who love him, and I know people who don't care for him, and I'm just sort of on the sidelines, and I'm like, I'm pro make as much money and have as much success as you can doing the thing that you love to do. And so that in that regard, I'm very much am a fan of Brandon Sanderson. Right. Mm-hmm. And I probably would like his books. I don't know. I just, I'm a little daunted by how thick they are. How many words they are. I don't know if you've ever seen them, but this guy goes and interviews, Brandon Sanderson from Wired. It's one of their head editors, and he spends a weekend with them, and he meets his family and his kids, and he's taking notes, and he writes up an article that absolutely just kind of tears him down and like insults him in a way, and insults his family and whatnot. And you read it and you're like, what kind of beef does he have? Like, is this guy jealous of all of his success? Is he, you know, and the fact too, that no one, he's, you know, he starts off the article, no one had heard in the Wired offices of Brandon Sanderson. And it's like, I know a lot of times, you know, pop culture things don't overlap, but I feel like if a guy has the most money ever made on Kickstarter, surely you would have heard about him at the Wired offices. Like, right. So I don't know why that blind spot there. Right. Anyways, the cool thing was his response. He wrote a response on Reddit that was really like, hey guys, you know, he's a fellow writer. Don't take out your anger on him. You know, some people's work isn't for everybody. It was really level-headed and cool. Mm-hmm. And it had a few little veiled digs at him as well. Like, mm-hmm. you know, clearly he was under deadline and he couldn't find a story. And so he had to put this out, you know. Anyway, but I wanted to go back to, had you heard anything about that, Lee?
I haven't, no.
Brandon Sanderson? Oh, you're muted. Hmm. The Brandon
that's
Sanderson.
That's
drama.
The best way
Sorry,
for me
no,
to be.
I...
That's why we.
You guys didn't even know
for
I
the
was
last
muted.
10 minutes.
I've been talking, putting out really, really important points.
Uh huh.
But I was muted.
But I wanted to bring up. So in that article, it led with the first paragraph was Brandon Sanderson made $55 million last year. 10 of that came from publishers. And 45 of that came from his own Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah, he's an outlier. He's, you know, the 0.1, 0.1, 0.1, 0.001 or whatever mm-hmm. of percentage of creators. But that's kind of where my head is at right now. Like you, either a publisher chooses you and says, we see something in your work and we're going to market the heck out of it and take it to the stars. Or you're kind of just at the mercy of your own marketing efforts. And I think we've talked about that on the podcast before where it's like, I'm like, yeah, you kind of got to do everything you can. And Lee's like, it doesn't matter what you do, your book's going to sell or it's not, mm-hmm. right? And I think it goes back down to what you said, Will, is you got to sort of start with the marketing in mind. Like, I think really what does the best is if someone who liked your book can easily pitch it to someone else. And for you, Will, it's like, do you like pickleball? Do you have kids? I've got a book for you. And it's mm-hmm. as simple as that. And you've said people are buying it without even flipping through it, right? Okay, so that's one thing. And then what I'm seeing in comics now too is like these mini series of comics coming out. One is called Ultra Mega, and it's about it's kind of like there's a Japanese superhero thing called Ultraman, and he's this giant robot guy that fights kaijus, right? And it was a huge phenomenon in Japan, still is. And so this guy James Herron, comic artist and writer, he created Ultra Mega, which was like his sort of love letter to that genre. And it's very easy in a comic shop for someone to say, you know, they show up with a Mighty Morphin Power Rangers comic, you know, or they get a Godzilla comic or an Ultraman comic. It's very easy for the person behind the table, like, oh, if you like this, you're going to love Ultraman because it's that, right? And there's another really cool comic series, mini series that came out called Do a Power Bomb, and it's all about pro wrestling but in another dimension, right? And so it's very easy to sell that, like, oh, you like pro wrestling, you're gonna love this book. Or even if you don't like pro wrestling, you're gonna be like, have you ever been curious or you want to find a way to like pro wrestling, read this book, you know, that's like the one sentence pitch. And so that's what I've been trying to think with, like, I really want to do a Skull Chaser comic with Image Comics. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how, like right now, as I'm writing the story and as I'm like fleshing this thing out, how do I make it so that it's easy to hand sell, you know, easy for someone to hand it to them and just say, hey. And the thing I keep coming back to is it's Mandalorian meets Hellboy, right? It's you like space cowboys, right? Which is what the Mandalorian is, mm-hmm. with some sort of metaphysical aspect to it. If you like those things, you're gonna like that. And so, I learned that more specifically on the Spaceships book that came out last year that I made, where it's called Kepler's Intergalactic Guide to Spaceships, but the spaceships is the biggest word on the cover. Mm-hmm. And so essentially I was like, I like spaceships. I'd read a book about spaceships. So let's call it essentially Spaceships. And sometimes that's all I refer to. It's my Spaceships book. And it's such an easy sell for people who love spaceships. You know, it's just like, right. Oh, you like spaceships? Here, you'll love this book.
Right. Right.
So sometimes you do need to make the complicated thing that defies description and your artistic integrity, you know, allows for that. Other times you just got to make it easy to sell, easy to hand off.
So like one really simple thing just to go along with your spaceships, mm-hmm. you made that really big. One of the things I decided was when I titled this book mm-hmm. was the word pickleball had to be in the title. It just had to be.
Yeah. Had to.
And for those of you who are following us on YouTube, we're on the School of Visual Storytelling channel. We hold stuff up there from time to time.
Yeah, you can see his book as he's pulling it up there. I like this episode. This is great because Lee is essentially on mute. He's probably doing his taxes while we're doing this.
I'm just listening. I'm taking a new Zen attitude. I'll add one word that'll profoundly change your conversation. I just got to wait.
Right.
We've been talking about, can I tease Self-Publishing Pro a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
Well, three of us have self-published enough stuff that we are thinking about making a class. I think we talked about this before, didn't we? We know we talked
about it. We've mentioned it on a couple of other sort of private live streams that we've been
doing.
That's
right.
With Patreon and whatnot.
So like our children's book pro class that we have at svslearn.com, we are thinking about doing a self-publishing pro class because this is the coolest thing to be able to, I mean, like for artists, like why did we get into this in the first place? Because we love to draw. That's mm-hmm. it. Right. And we mm-hmm. love to draw certain things and we don't like to draw other things. And as illustrators, one of the problems is you're constantly getting asked to draw things that you don't necessarily aren't really in your love circle. They're kind of just outside of it somewhere or even far out of it. And mm-hmm. some of those we turn down. Some of them we take reluctantly because we think it might lead to better things. Mm-hmm. We think or the money's really good or whatever. But we often get pulled and pushed out of what we really want to make. And self-publishing gives you, I mean, like lightning fast. If I had taken this, first off, for like a second, I thought about taking this Pickleball Paul to one of my publishers mm-hmm. for like a day. I thought about that. Right. Yeah. I was like, one, they're not going to be interested, even though pickleball is the fastest growing sport in North America, I believe. Mm-hmm. It's probably too niche, but mm-hmm. what if they do, you know, then it takes me out of all the marketing. What if they do want it? And I get $20,000-$30,000 up front. Mm-hmm. Now they have control of it and they get to decide if there's another one made. Well, I have five right. planned. What if it doesn't sell well enough and they say no, but they own that name and I can't continue making it. So that was one thing I was thinking of. But the other one was, what if they change the story to a story that I don't like?
Right. You That's know? The big one.
Yeah. And what if they change the characters? You know, I have animal characters in this, what if they want it to be human? And I, for reasons, you know, like race and gender and stuff, that's why I like to do animals, is because any kid can see those animals and see themselves in those characters. Whereas with human characters, it's a little tougher. There's there's issues that you have to be really, really careful of. And for me, I don't ever think you could get it right for everyone. So it's just easier for me to go the animal route. But yeah, so I thought about that for a second. I'm like, no, this is, I want control. I want to be able to decide my own fate on this.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing
the beautiful thing about it too, is that it's changed my attitude towards traditional publishing as well, because before, like say 10 years ago, I'd make a dummy and then pray that it got purchased and none of that stuff that you just said happens. They change the story or whatever.
Right.
And you know, if it didn't get published, which some of these stories didn't, what all of them didn't, let me add that, Ash, none of them got purchased. Then they just sat in a drawer for 10 years. And now the book I'm writing right now, I have this sort of ace up my sleeve kind of feeling that if you don't buy this, I will make this. And I know it's, I've got enough trust in my instinct at this point where I know it will sell to an audience that cares about the things that I care about and the sensibilities that I like. And so it may not be a huge, you know, global worldwide seller, but it will make enough money for me to make this thing that I care about. And now I have a fail safe. If the publishers don't pick it up or they try to change the story, I'll say nope. And I'll just do it on my own. And it gives you sort of a safety net because these books take a long time.
Right.
Yeah. And this is a point I wanted to make too, was 12 publishers passed on J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter submission.
Right.
Before one publisher was like, yeah, we'll do it. And I was reading another thing about Tom Petty, his first album, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, which had Free Falling on it, which is listed as one of the top 500 songs ever written. Mm. And I think it has like three more hits on that album as well. It's a good album. He recorded it. And Warner Brothers was like, we can't, this doesn't have a hit on it. We don't love this. And he's super bummed because they like essentially were like, yeah, we're not going to make a contract. And I was reading about it, and this is from Tom Petty's biography. And so he's running in the entertainment industry circles, right? Because he's, you know, recording and doing all this stuff and doing live shows and everything. And he ends up getting invited to this party that's thrown by these record producers, right? And they're like inviting everybody who's anybody at this party. So he shows up to it. Guess who's at that party? George Harrison, you know, one of the Beatles.
He's at a lot of parties I go to, so that's normal.
Yeah, you know, you've seen him around, right? Before he died. Anyways, so George Harrison is like, Tom, why don't you come over here? Let's play a little guitar.
That wasn't bad.
That was pretty good. I'm going to give you that. That was solid.
I do one impression well, and that's the Beatles. No, never get to guess it. Anyways, so they start strumming, playing guitar, and he's like, this is really good. You've got, so they, he's like, what was that free falling song? And so he starts playing Free Falling. They're like, this is really good. Anyway, there's a producer there from MCA Records, you know, the other big record, and they're listening to it. And they're like, well, if George Harrison likes this song, you know, maybe we've got a hit album here. So they make this huge offer. They're like, hey, we'll do your thing. And Tom Petty's like, he's like, oh, sweet, I got this offer. But I think he had rights of first refusal with Warner Brothers. So he went back to him and say, hey, MCA really wants to go to town with this album. And they're like, okay, fine, we'll publish it. You know, we'll cut you a deal, cut a record. And the rest is history. Like, he creates one of the best albums in rock and roll in the 80s. And so the point of that story and the point of the J.K. Rowling story, and kind of the whole thing here is nobody knows anything.
Yeah.
No,
they don't. They have a 9-to-1 or 10-to-1. Some publishers have an 11-to-1 publishing in, we're talking about children's books.
Yeah.
And novels. They publish 9, and out of those 9, eight of them lose money, and one of them pays for those losses and gives enough profit to stay profitable as a company. So they pick, they basically have the shotgun approach. And with this guy that I was telling you about earlier, who wrote me the letter and said that basically they're camping on his project and not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
And basically just stole his project from, just not stole because they paid him in advance, but they paid him in advance on one book. That's what they do. They just buy up all kinds of properties, hoping that something takes off. And in fact, what I've heard from editors is a lot of times the publisher will wait to see what just starts taking off on its own. And they don't know why. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's got the right cover art. Maybe it's the right title. Maybe who mm-hmm. knows what it is, but it starts to sell. And on their sales stats, they see the 9 books that they just published. And one of them is starting to break out a little bit. Maybe the author mm-hmm. or illustrator is pumping it or pushing it. Who knows? But it's gaining traction. Then they start spending money and mm-hmm. putting money behind that project. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe the other ones just didn't get seen by the right people, you know?
Right. Right. Here's the thing too. And say what you will about NFTs. I'm not, I don't own any. I'm not a fan of them. I don't, like, I haven't made any NFTs.
Give us more disclaimer before you.
But yes, I'm totally hedging here. Anyways, the way that works, I have a friend who's deep in that world, you know, and he's always telling me about how it works and whatnot, and can't stop talking about it. But essentially, any one of these really successful NFT projects all work because there's some sort of influencer who's like, yeah, I'll mm-hmm. I'll pump it for you. Mm-hmm. And it's all word of mouth, and it's all people are like, well, if that guy likes it, then I'll buy it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think the core of all this is we now live in a time where you have access to publishing, self-publishing, access to printers, you have access to a way to get pre-orders, whether it's through Kickstarter or just setting up your own online shop. You have access to all the same exact marketing tools that every publisher has. They all have their social media accounts and their email lists and everything. You have access to all this. You could do it all yourself if you want to. Now, there is a caveat to that, and that is, it's a lot of work, right? Mm-hmm. But I think for us, the three of us, there's a way to make it work. And I think in a way it does pay off. Like if you add up how many Kickstarters have you done, Will, that have successfully funded?
Two.
How much money did that bring in? Net. I mean, we'll do gross. It's easier.
Gross. $270,000.
Okay, Lee, you know I was going to ask you this too. What about you?
Two as well. It's about $100,000.
Okay, so we're at $370,000 between you two, and then I've done 5, I think now, or 6. And we'll just say I can't do the math off the top of my head, but we'll say $300,000 between all of them. So we're well over $500,000. Money generated between three of us doing self-publishing with just a handful of books. And I think between all of us, we've sold 20,000 copies of books as well. Now, that's nothing compared to what publishers do, right? But
however,
you're getting such a small percentage of what the publishers do mm-hmm. that it almost makes it kind of worth it to do it. And I say that because you got to kind of go into this knowing what you want to, because sometimes it may not be a financial incentive to go with a publisher. It might be just reach. Like it might just be credibility too, because mm-hmm. there is some credibility when a publisher who has limited Absolutely. Amount of resources picks you to do a book. And so maybe part of a person's career publishing plans is I get some credibility first. You know, I'd really try to get that book published. I get some credibility. I get some distribution because, you know, even low sales for a children's book is going to far outweigh how many books you sell on a Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the least amount of books usually they order is what, 5,000, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's 5,000 books that end up in how many different bookstores and on Amazon and whatever. So that gets you some distribution and sort of awareness about your stuff. But you might still make less money or equivalent amount of money as if you self-publish, you know, a couple thousand books. Mm-hmm. So I think the overall thing is you kind of weigh everything and say, well, maybe my full publishing goal here is to have the credibility and the distribution on this side and leverage that to do my own personal thing. And I see some of these artists do this kind of thing where they'll maybe publish a book at Image Comics, or they'll publish a book through Scholastic or you know, any one of these publishers, but then they have an online shop and they have a way for them to like to funnel these people that the publisher is, you know, taking them to their book, and then through that book funneling them into their shop, and they're able to build that audience, build that email list, build those sort of customers for the things that they're doing. I think that's the path forward. Publishing's not going to collapse. I mean, we're not talking about that, but I think there's a path forward for artists to be able to like kind of balance it all. It doesn't have to be all or nothing, but I think there's something there.
Yeah. I mean, on this project alone, I'm with 5,000 books. If I sold 5,000 books through my publisher, Random House, Penguin Random House, I would get royalties of about $3,750. Mm-hmm. $3,750. When I sell 5,000, these behind me, my profit right around $50,000. Mm-hmm. So the margins that you're dealing with self-publishing are so much better. They spend a lot more time marketing.
And so what do you say to the artist who's like, I don't have a business bone in my body. All I want to do is create.
Better get one. we're getting to the time right now. Yeah, I mean, like, really, like,
I agree.
We're getting to the time right now where because I can do this and because other artists can do this, we're now making more noise and competing for more dollars and attention, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's more illustrators and authors now than there ever have been. And publishers have access to more illustrators and authors than they ever have. Mm-hmm. So your chances of being picked are getting less and less theoretically every year. Mm-hmm. I would imagine. I mean, I don't have metrics on that, but as populations increase, right, you would imagine that there are just more and more people. There are more art schools now than there was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, there's the other more thing is, you know, when you're making your own stuff, you become more desirable to publishers as well. I mean, there's always that feeling like, you know, I don't know if I want to use this analogy, but we'll go ahead and do it. You know, if you already have a girlfriend, there's other girls that want to be with you.
Well, because you've proven that there's something about you. Yeah,
somebody liked you, and you don't look desperate. And I think I really do think that desperation, when you're like, please, somebody hire me, it just comes across. I don't know what it is about that, but people who are good and people who just keep moving forward, there's something alluring about that. I think to publishers too. They know that you know how to do it, and you're busy, and you don't need them, and then so they want you. It's kind of a weird balance there. But it's nice also for you because, like, you know, if you get hired by a publisher, that's awesome. If you don't, hey, that's also awesome. There's no lose. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think about artists partnering with a business, someone who is more business minded? Like, well, if you knew, so you're partnering with a salesman. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason you're partnering with them is just you can't run the publishing and be at every pickleball.
Yeah. Like thing, you said, right? I think the most of our sales are going to come direct, retail at tournaments all over the country. Yeah. I can't do that.
Right. That's not feasible. So maybe the idea there is, if you don't have the business bone, you've got to have some business sense to at least find someone who does, I think, and to be able to partner with them and be able to understand what they're doing just as much as they understand what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like, I kind of think it would be so cool. And you start to see some of this happening where there's maybe like these little collectives where a bunch of artists get together and they have sort of a business person, that can run and manage a business. Maybe it's self-publishing or something like that, and make your own little publishing company where we're going to launch, you know, 5 Kickstarters this year with 5 different artists. And maybe some of that money all goes back into the company, and maybe there's a distribution where everybody's involved in promoting it. And so everybody gets a little piece of everybody's Kickstarter pie. I kind of like, I don't know if that's actually happening, but I'm sort of coming up with this as I talk about it. That does sound kind of interesting, wouldn't it? Huh.
Well, there's all kinds of...
We keep talking about coming up with our own publishing company to help people along who don't have the network and the know-how. But again, it always... we have so many ideas between the three of us, just so you guys know. We talk about it all the time. And then we get all excited about it. And then what happens? We are like, oh, that's going to be a lot of work. And then we don't do it. Right? That, well, that happens so much.
I was telling Lily this, my wife, the other day. I was saying... there are so many opportunities right now that I can't take advantage of all of them.
Right.
I mean, like I want to clone myself so that I can be working on Self-Publishing Pro. I have another book idea that goes outside of this series that I don't have time to work on right now that I know would do really, really well. And I can't work on that. And so, but you know, I keep going back to the fact that I think that now is the time in our world technologically where these tools, I mean, like we set up our pick and pack ship station. We've been setting it up for a while, but we used it this week, and the software that you have to help you ship, the companies that provide labels that are really, and printers and just every single thing that you need to do it at home didn't exist 20, 30 years ago.
No,
it's just so recent.
Even
you know,
10 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, like
so much more.
It's crazy.
Refined.
You have companies that provide all the boxes and packaging so that you can easily package this stuff up and do it from home, run it over to the post office and drop it off. It doesn't take much time out of your day. And we're going through this process and I'm like, there's all these companies involved along the way that made this possible that weren't here just a little while ago.
Yeah. So this Self-Publishing Pro class that we're talking about, this course, it would be start to finish. You've got your idea, or maybe you don't even have your idea, but like starting with an idea to...
Well, I think we would start with how to generate an idea from a marketing standpoint. Like these ideas, not good. They're too mass market. They're too, they're what publishers are looking for. And provide a bunch of ideas. Like for instance, one niche would be, a child that is, got a specific disease might be really niche, but like, you know, it could be kids that, have diabetes. That's a large, very targeted group. Yeah, it's a large group of kids.
What's the saying? Niche and get rich.
Yeah.
Or the I like the version niche and get rich.
Well, let's say you're a parent of a child who has gone through that, who was born with type 1 diabetes, right? And so you went through the process of, you know, having this baby. We have a family of friends that went through this where they had this kid, they thought everything was normal. And then at like 2 or 3 years old, it's like, oh, all these problems you're having, come on in and get tested. Oh, your kid has diabetes. This is a lifelong challenge that mm-hmm. you guys are going to have to deal with right now, starting right now. And the kid doesn't know. And so you have this perspective that you can write about a book for parents and kids, or just for the kid. What is it like to be the kid that grows up with diabetes? I mean, there's all kinds of aspects of doing a niche book like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can easily identify those people because they're all getting publications. So there's a newsletter that's going to all of them, right? Mm-hmm. There's hospitals that often will give out books. So if you had a soft cover Amazon version mm-hmm. that was cheap that they could give out,
yeah.
I mean, there's just so many different ideas that you could do to get to be able to illustrate the thing that you want to illustrate that you're passionate about, that you really care about, and put it out in the world.
What would you title a book like that? Would you put diabetes in the title, like David has diabetes? I mean, that's pretty on the nose.
No, you got to use the opportunity there. I'm going to beaties the diabetes.
That works. It doesn't. I'm going to beaties the diabetes.
But it's got.
Wow.
It's going to be catchy. I'm just throwing down options.
I probably would have diabetes in the title.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just so it was very clear.
Very clear. Yeah.
What the book would be. So, yeah. So I think we got to do it. I think we got to do this course. All right. Well, there's a question actually goes right along with this. Maybe we'll answer that. We'll save one of the other question for another episode. But this comes in from one of our patrons. She says, I recently got the opportunity for a portfolio review with a couple of folks at the CAT agency. The main feedback they offered was that my portfolio primarily contains fantasy subjects.
Wait one second, Jake.
Yeah.
Are we done with the self-publishing talk? We're going into actual questions? Because I wanted to throw this out there. We're going to do a little giveaway here at SVS if people are listening. If you
we are.
It involves Will and Jake doing work, but not me. If Jake has these really, really cool little octopus pens, that's the Inktober sort of logo, right? Can you show that?
Cool. It's this character I made for Inktober.
We're giving away one octopus pen. If you can,
what?
Will has hidden a pickle on every page, every spread of his pickleball book. If you can list where each pickle is and on what page it is, you list all those. The first one we get with the correct answer gets a free octopus pen.
And a free Art of Lee White book. You gotta get some skin in this.
That's too much skin. That's too much skin.
And a free Pickleball Paul book.
Yeah, there you go.
The already package from all three of us.
Free pickle. I'll give you something. Didn't say that.
Okay. Where do they submit it to?
They send it to info at svslearn.com. If you have the right answer.
svslearninfo@gmail.com, right? What? No.
Which one is it? It's info at svslearn.com.
That's right. Oh. All right. Thanks for that.
We didn't even know that was going to happen, but
no.
I like giving away Jake's stuff. He doesn't know.
Yeah, I like Will having to work, Jake having to work, and me not having to do anything.
It's like, hey, if you can tell me how many cats Lee White has drawn in all of his published works, Lee White will do a free oil change in your car.
The problem with that is I don't know how many cats I've drawn, hard to get the answer to go in there.
Can I do this question now really quick?
Okay. This isn't one of the ones that you gave us though, right?
It is. It's the second one.
Oh, okay.
So this girl, she had an opportunity to do a portfolio view with an agency, and this is the feedback they gave her, is that her portfolio primarily contains fantasy subjects, but the fantasy genre isn't performing great right now in picture books and middle grade markets. They suggested I pivot to more contemporary subjects to find work. Admittedly, I was a little bummed to hear this since I really love the fantasy genre. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the fantasy segment of children's publishing and if you had any recommendations. So my initial thought here is this goes back to kind of what we're saying. Like the publishing industry is so fickle. Like they will see a downturn, a little dip in fantasy book selling and decide, you know, we can't invest any more money in people who do fantasy art. So, and they see a little spike, like one book takes off that does a particular genre really well. And now that's all they want. And here's kind of what I think is it's a thing I talked about in my newsletter last week. And what it is you've got two options, making opportunity and chasing opportunity. This is kind of like the crux of everything we've talked about today. The difference between opportunity you make and opportunity you chase is that opportunity you make is born out of passion, and opportunity you chase is usually born out of desperation. Okay. Mm. And I have a friend who we were talking about this, and he succinctly put it this way. He said, a project born not from passion, but from opportunity or from chasing opportunity may bear fruit, but it's almost always bitter. Okay. Mm. So now, you know, I've got a mortgage, I've got kids, mouths to feed, right? So I will take any kind of fruit, bitter or sweet, just as long as I'm getting fruit, you know? So at some point, you got to do, if that's important to you, and if you need to get work, then you got to modify your portfolio to meet the tastes and the needs for what the people hiring are looking for. But I think you always leave room for you to make opportunity. And the way that you do that is you do the thing that you love to do, that you're good at doing, and you kind of put that out in the world, and eventually I think the world replies and says, we want this, we need this. Mm-hmm. So, and this is a quote from James Clear. He wrote Atomic Habits, which is a book I highly recommend you check out. He says, if you spend too much time working on good things, then you don't have much time left to work on great things. Understanding opportunity costs means eliminating good uses of time, and that's what makes it hard. So I think the solution here is don't abandon fantasy, but if you do need work, then start making some contemporary looking, you know, what they describe it? Contemporary subjects is what is said in there. So, you know, a kid in the classroom, a kid at the dentist's office, you know, a kid, you know, playing sports or something like that. And that gives you an opportunity to do work. But then I say you always also keep a little portion of yourself to make your fantasy project, do your thing. Mm-hmm. You guys have thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is, you have to keep everything in perspective. This is one person telling you to make a career change. And right. You should never make a career change based on one person's opinion.
Right.
If 10 people in 10 different agencies or 10 different publishers are telling you, hey, we think that market's dead, that you should switch, then for what they do and for the publishers they work for and the markets that they're shooting for, yeah, it's probably mm-hmm. true. But that doesn't mean you can't also turn to self-publishing, as we've been talking about. I remember someone telling me that a prominent art director told this friend of mine who's an illustrator when they left school, said, this is the worst portfolio I've ever seen, and you should do anything but illustration, and was flipping about it and was short and just left. Like this person got in to see this guy, and that's all he had to say. And then he just left the room and left him devastated. Right. Mm-hmm. And my friend decided like after picking herself up, she somehow moved forward with her career and has gone on to do quite a lot in illustration, but that was
why would you say that to someone?
I have no idea. I have no idea. So and
crazy.
And she was like, you know, that actually made me dig in and work harder. And she saw this art director later on, or contacted him online. I can't remember. And he didn't remember her at all. So they don't remember you at all. They have no investment, right? And, but they're going to give you potentially life changing advice.
Right.
You got to be careful of that.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead, Lee.
It's just bizarre for somebody to give that kind of a broad feedback. And I got to say, I've always hated, I was going to say dislike, but I've hated those broad overviews. Like you can don't do rhyme when you write a story. Oh, don't do fantasy. It seems so limiting and so small-minded to me. There's so many versions of all this stuff that, you know, while one may work, the other won't work, and it's going to be independent on what you'd make. And there's always a market for it too. Like, you know, they say, oh, you only got to do, you know, historical nonfiction now. I mean, it's just goofy. Anytime I get those call orders, I make it a point to never make any of those images.
That's too funny. And actually, last week, Lee and I did, we started a thing at SVS Learn called Power Portfolio Reviews. Is that what they're called? That's the official name?
Yeah, well, Portfolio Pro. We're kind of still bouncing the name around. But
yeah, but it's like sort of testing it out and seeing how we like working with it. And we offered it just to SVS Learn subscribers, a chance to get a very in-depth, detailed portfolio review. And the two people I met with, so what it is you pay $325, something like that. But what you're getting is a half hour recorded video of a very in-depth, like, here's what's going good in your portfolio. Here's what you need to work on. Here's how you need to present your portfolio better. And then once you've gone through and read like this very detailed accounting, we've got a rubric that goes over it of your, you know, this audit of your portfolio. Then you meet with us one-on-one for another 30 minutes. And we get into like specifics. You can ask questions, get real-time answers. And we just have a conversation about what to do and sort of chart a course for you moving forward. And that's the kind of thing where I think you look back at, you know, money well spent, because you actually have direction and you're not wasting time because you know where you're supposed to be going. And that's right there, I think, does so much more for you than sitting with, you know, just getting professional eyes on something and in a 10-minute span, them making, you know, really shoot from the hip type of commentary on where you're going and what you're doing with your art. And that's not something that you should put too much stock into, versus, you know, these two people I met with. Like, I spent a good 3 hours before even meeting with them just going through, analyzing, looking at, oh, this is a good piece. Oh, this could be, you know, I did drawers for these people. Like, here's how I would fix this thing and make it better. So that's something that, that if that's something interested to you, get on our email list, because right now that's how we're letting people know about these portfolio reviews. We'll have a landing page soon, but if you get on the email list, next time an email goes out about the, you know, the Power Portfolios or Portfolio Pro or whatever we call it, then you can definitely get on board with that. Anyway,
I tell you what to look for when you guys are getting reviews is not, oh, take this whole thing out, like Will said, career changing advice. It's, and this is what I say in the portfolio reviews that I give, is don't listen to my solution. There's a million solutions for making an image better. Listen to what I'm responding to.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm not that interested in this image. Why not? That's more important to talk about than, oh, you know, if I move this over here and change your contrast, then all of a sudden it's better. That may be the answer that I would have, but I always preclude it with, come up with your own. If something's going to feel right to you, maybe what I suggest isn't going to feel right in terms of a solution, but let's identify the problem. That's the best portfolio review you can have. But this big global, you can't do this and you can do that. You should do that. It's silly.
Yeah.
And before we finish, can I circle back to something we were talking about?
Circle back. then we'll wrap it up.
Okay. So I just want to, I had a thought and I want to revisit, like, you know, we've been talking a lot about self-publishing. And I'm thinking, like, if I were listening to this episode out there, what would I think of three of us who have been in traditional publishing? We've published, like we say in the beginning of the show, somewhere around 75 books with traditional publishers. And then we've kind of moved on to doing, not moved on, but are currently excited about self-publishing. Let's say that. If I were listening to this, I might think, well, yeah, maybe it's because you guys aren't doing good enough with your publishers. But the question that I would ask that person thinking that somewhat logical thought would be, well, if Brandon Sanderson, you said in the Wired article, it said he made 10,000 or 10 million from his publishers the same year that he made $43 million on Kickstarter. And I know Brandon personally, and I knew him before he shot to the stratosphere. I presented with him before at conferences, and
why haven't we had him on the podcast if you're best buds with them?
I'm not best buds, but we're on a first name basis. I mean, like, he'll say hi to me if he sees me.
Yeah, bring him on, man. That would be fun to talk to somebody like that. A successful person.
Yeah, but the question would be why he was making millions on the series that he was finishing, The Wheel of Time, I think it was. Was that the one? He was making millions before he ever did that Kickstarter. Why someone who was arguably in the top 1% previous to that mega year, doing really good in publishing, why would he take the time to do these books on his own?
Well, and I'll
kickstart it.
I'll answer that too. It's first off, he didn't know he was going to have a $43 million Kickstarter. I think that it blew him away as well.
Oh yeah.
His Kickstarter previous to that made 3 or 4 million, something like that. And I think he was just planning
It was actually 7.
Okay. Really?
Yeah. Was it? I think so.
What? We should probably have these numbers, but I'm sure he was thinking, well, let's try and beat that. You know, I've got 3 books I'm publishing here. Let's try to beat it. But prior to that, the reason he opened up his own like shop and his own like publishing, like self-publishing thing is the publishers didn't want to do nice leather bound, high quality versions of his books. Because that doesn't make financial sense for the publisher, I guess. They didn't know if
it doesn't work in their world. They don't, it's an unknown thing.
Right. And he's like, well, I know my people, he's the guy that's going to all the cons and all the fantasy events and everything. And everybody's saying to him what they want. He's the one that knows kind of what it is. And so I'm sure he's like, yeah, I'd do a killing at these. And every time I'm at these places, I could sell them and I could put them on my shop. And so that's why he started his own self-publishing thing, is because he was doing something that he knew his publisher wouldn't want to do. And I think that is where everybody's head is at, who's done traditional publishing, who's doing self-publishing, is there just really is limitations to it. You know, there's a handful of really stellar talent that can just roll up to a publisher and say, hey, here's my idea for my next book. And they'll just say, okay, here's your advance, go make it, you know. But the rest of us don't really have that luxury. And you do have that luxury in the self-publishing realm. Yeah. Okay, we did a full episode on self-publishing. I'm going to wrap it up there.
Pat ourselves on the back.
All right, guys, thanks for joining us. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by SVSLearn.com, where becoming a great illustrator starts. And your hosts today have been Will Terry, Lee White, and Jake Parker. You can find us on Instagram and at our websites. And it's WillTerry.com and at WillTerryArt. It's LeeWhiteIllustration.com and at LeeWhiteIllo. And it's MrJakeParker.com and at Jake Parker. Special thanks to Daniel Tu, who's our podcast producer, and that's Daniel TU, and you can find his work at daniel2.co. Special thanks to our show notes wrangler, Lily Howell, and also our chief operations officer, Lisa Fott. That's it. Now, go draw something. You know, the other day, though, we sat down to dinner and I dug into the lasagna and I'm like, honey, this lasagna is bussin'. And the kids just all like kind of bowed their heads and were like so embarrassed. Bussin's a new word. That means cool.
All right. Bussin'.
Bussin'. Try that on your kid. See what he says.
Let me write that down. I'm trying to think of if he's told me any other words. I know that goofy ah is a thing. Bussin'. Like B-U-S-S-I-N.
Well, your kids are all moved out. So when you see them, they're all like on best behavior, right? They're like, dad's here. We got to like, you know, take the trash out, wash the dishes. And
right. Because they come down here to visit. And it's like, it's not the house they grew up in. So they're like,
right.
Yeah.
I tell you what, me and Emerson are bonding over lately is Karen videos. In this day and age of everything being recorded, these videos are hilarious. And you can't believe how mad middle-aged women get.
And guys.
But it's mainly women, but yeah, there's some guys for sure. The Kevins.
Oh, there's tons of guys.
A lot of parking. A lot of people upset about parking.
Oh my gosh. I have seen people like, I mean, do trade illegal activity. I mean, like for their anger, you know, like, like completely lose it. And then like bash somebody with their car.
Right.
Or like someone will park behind someone because they took their spot.
Right.
And then that person starts slamming into them. And I'm like, at what point don't you weigh these consequences? Like, how do you get that jacked out of your mind?
People get in that rage mode.
They get so. We saw one yesterday where they.
Go for it, Lee.
The guy backs into the person. Same kind of situation. Like they're, you know, road raging, and the person in front backs into the car in front of him, but then it lifts him onto the bumper, and they're stuck. The car in front is like smoking the tires, just trying to separate, but they're not going anywhere. Awesome.
No, my favorite one is where some guy tries to pull out in front of the other. It's a dash cam. And the person like screeches to stop and he's like, you know, whatever. And so he just zooms. And right as he like zooms out, this guy that was in the wrong, like he rear ends somebody.
Right.
Ah, so good.
It's like instant karma. I think that's a Reddit, like, what is it called? Subreddit is instant karma. You just go and look at
I've seen a ton of those. A lot of Karens against skateboarders. There was one old dude yelling at people in the skate park for skating.
I don't get that.
He was trying to kick them while they were on the ramp. I tell you this much: if I was there, I'd have beat that guy's ass. if the second he tried to kick a kid, I'd have kicked his ass. I'm ready. I'm triggered by the Kevins. I'm waiting to punch somebody.
Well, you're a skater.
pushed the kids off when they were like going to go, you know, ollie down some stairs or whatever. Pushed the kid off, like super dangerous move.
What is up with that?
Got to be a special kind
who's
of Karen.
Complaining? Well, who's complaining about pickleball courts?
Well,
because I know those are getting some heat for the
there's some Kevins and Karens coming out their back door going, you know, yelling. There's somebody put oil all over a court behind it, you know. Yeah, because it was in a neighborhood and they figured that one of the homeowners like dumped a barrel of oil because that stops play. I mean, they didn't play on that court. I don't even know if they have it cleaned up yet. They just slicked it all down so that no one could play. Yeah, just drug it across a bunch of courts. So that there's like a slip zone. It didn't ruin the whole court, but you can't play on it because if you step on that spot, you're going to slip and fall down, you know?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. That's extreme pickleball. All right. Should we get started?